When she was growing up in a white suburban area of Michigan, Minal Hajratwala was embarrassed by her brown skin, her mother's curries, and even her name. Now, 3 decades later, she's finally comfortable in asking a question that many immigrants eventually come to ask: where did we come from? And she's written a book that traces her family history and the history of millions of Indians living abroad today, called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from 5 Villages to 5 Continents. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that has brought Minal Hajratwala to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You spent much of your childhood trying to divorce yourself from all things Indian. What prompted you to delve so deeply into your family's history?
Well, I think that experience of childhood was really coming out of a place of loneliness and alienation. And once I went to university and connected with other South Asians of my own generation, I got really interested in understanding where I had come from and where my family had come from and how we had ended up where we were in the suburbs of Michigan.
Yeah, there were no other Indians in Canton, Michigan. I've never even heard of Canton, Michigan. I know Canton, Ohio.
Yes, Canton, Michigan is much smaller than Canton, Ohio. It's about halfway between Ann Arbor and Detroit, and there were a few other Indian families. It was just a fairly small number, and for me it was a difficult place to grow up.
In researching this book, you logged more than 40,000 miles, spent 7 years interviewing family members. How many relatives did you wind up speaking to?
I spoke to about somewhere between 75 and 100 relatives all over the world in 9 different countries.
Where are we talking about 9 different countries?
I went to New Zealand, Australia, Fiji, Hong Kong, South Africa, England, India, United States, and Canada. So that's all the places that I have relatives.
36 first cousins. That's a lot of first cousins. How many of them live in the United States?
I would say maybe about 10 live in the United States.
Did some of them see you as something of a stranger?
In a way, yes.
Hi, cousin. We have never met.
I had met most of my cousins before, but maybe as a child. We were strangers in the sense that we had maybe not had in-depth adult conversations, and it was exciting during the process of interviewing them about their lives to really become intimate with my family members in a way that I wouldn't have otherwise.
I mentioned the subtitle of your book, My Family's Journey from 5 Villages to 5 Continents, and you've listed the 5 continents, but what about the 5 villages? Where are they?
The 5 villages are all clustered together in the southern part of the state of Gujarat in western India.
Now, the Indian diaspora goes back a long time. It's an outgrowth of British colonialism, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we see Indians in Africa. We see Indians in the Caribbean.
Exactly. And that modern Indian diaspora is definitely an outcome of India's connection with the British Empire and the British need for labor in the colonies that it was developing in the 1800s and 1900s.
What about the story of your great-grandfather who went to Fiji?
Yes, Motiram Narsi was his name, and he went to Fiji in 1909 as a tailor, and he started a small tailoring shop there, and eventually that shop became one of the largest department stores in the South Pacific Islands.
Were there a lot of Indians in Fiji?
There were. There was a large indentured laboring community in Fiji, and then around the time that my great-grandfather went in 1909, there started to be a large entrepreneurial community as well.
Now, why so many indentured servants?
The British practice of indenturing Indian and also Chinese laborers came right on the heels of the end of slavery. So in August 1834, slavery was outlawed in the British Empire. And in September of that same year, the first indentured laborers were signed up in India.
And often the slave ships would just switch over to indentured servant ships.
Exactly. They didn't have the shackles, but otherwise everything was pretty much the same.
Wow. And then your grandfather marched with Mahatma Gandhi against India's salt tax. So was he the son of the great-grandfather who was in Fiji?
No, this is my grandfather on my mother's side. His name was Narottam, and he was one of thousands of peasants who joined Mahatma Gandhi's salt march to protest the British tax on salt in 1931.
You say that your family's journey parallels the broader Indian diaspora. Did most of the people leave voluntarily? I'm getting the feeling that an awful lot of people left because they had no choice in the matter.
Yes. In my family, actually, most of the migration was voluntary. In the larger diaspora, much of the indentured migration was not voluntary. People were tricked into signing contracts and didn't quite know where they were going. But in my family, it was really a matter of a combination of economic need and some choice and agency about where to go.
What brought your parents to the United States?
My father came to the United States to earn his master's degree in pharmacy and then his PhD. And my mother came when she married him in 1967. She was a physical therapist. And they were both part of what they call the brain drain generation, where really the smartest and most educated and professionally qualified people from all over the world were suddenly being invited and encouraged to immigrate to the United States.
Well, many came here and said, I'll get my education, learn a little bit, and then go back and help my people, and never went back.
Exactly. And that was the case with my parents, too. It was sort of a combination of incidents, including opportunities here that they didn't feel that they could get back home that made them stay in the United States.
Has that changed now? Because we hear about a lot of Americans going to India these days to get top-level medical treatment at a price a lot less expensive than you can get in the United States.
Yes, and there's also a small trend of remigration, which is Indo-Americans of my generation returning to India to set up businesses and take advantage of a new entrepreneurial climate there.
But wouldn't you be a real outsider? Do you speak any of the Indian languages? Would you speak Hindi?
I don't speak very much Hindi. I speak Gujarati, which is the language of our community, but I speak it with a very heavy American accent that people find very comical.
And you speak English with an American accent, which they would find odd as well, because a lot of people speak English in India, but not with the same accent you have.
Exactly. They have a very distinct either British or Indo-British accent.
You said that Indians were being encouraged to come here, not just Indians, people from all over the world. Why were they?
Yes. Yeah, so in 1965, Lyndon Johnson signed the Immigration Act that completely transformed American immigration policy. Prior to that, Asians in particular had been basically barred from emigrating to the United States. And after 1965, Asians were allowed to come into the United States on the same level as other immigrants.
And that changed the Chinese population of the United States considerably.
Absolutely.
Indian as well. Is that why we see Indians all over the United States? Often, I mean, some of them as doctors and lawyers, et cetera, but some of them running motels in small towns in the South?
Yes, and there's a part of my book where I talk about how the motel industry developed, which is really interesting. Indo-Americans now own about 50% of the motel and hotel rooms in the United States.
How did that happen? It was just one person bought a motel and said, this is a good business?
Something like that, yes. It was a combination of factors, including the opening of Disney World in Florida and the opening of the interstates, and all these motels came up along the interstates. And at the same time, there were Indo-Americans who had perhaps professional qualifications in their home country, but once they got here, they weren't licensed to practice as a doctor, for example, or something like that, or they felt that they could do better on their own, running their own business. And so they decided to buy up some small motels, and eventually that grew into an economic niche that worked well for them.
Well, I was just talking with an Indian entrepreneur about the resistance to entrepreneurship in India until fairly recently. So I guess people who had that kind of spirit found it a lot easier to do well here, at least until recent times.
Yes, and partly it was also a matter of necessity because there was racial discrimination in the workplace. And so sometimes people felt like they could get to a certain point and then they would hit a glass ceiling and not really be able to get to the next level of management. And it was just much better to work for themselves. They could do better for themselves.
Now, there are a number of celebrated diasporas. There's the Jewish diaspora, the Armenian diaspora, of course, the African diaspora. Do they have certain things in common with the Indian diaspora?
I think one of the things that diasporas have in common is that there is a sense of a place that is a home and a sense of having left that place and having all the nostalgia and grief and loss that might exist for that place, whether that place is remembered accurately or not. And then at the same time, there is a sense of gain in the new country. And so there are both things always happening. Some things are lost, some things are gained.
There's also some bonding with the new country, isn't there? We see it with someone like V.S. Naipaul, who seems to have made more of a connection with British traditions than he has with Indian traditions, although he seems to be a bit ambivalent. He's not a unique case either.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think here we see it in culture as well. We see a blending of things like Bhangra music and hip-hop, or Bollywood music and disco. And there are these fusions that can happen that wouldn't exist in the original country.
And what happens with something I just asked my previous guest about, Slumdog Millionaire, which won so many Oscars, but at the same time paints a rather ugly, and he said, stereotypical picture of modern-day India. Is this a movie that makes diaspora Indians proud or not so proud?
I think diaspora Indians are mixed on it. I find that it's certainly an important moment in the diaspora that we see a British Indian actor like Dev Patel and a British Sri Lankan musician like MIA coming to national prominence and international prominence through that kind of a mainstream Western movie.
We also almost had an Indian Surgeon General.
Yes.
Sanjay Gupta, but then he just decided to turn the job down. I guess he's making too much money on television.
Well, I just thought it was amazing to watch Sanjay Gupta be up for the nomination and then also watch on television a South Asian comedian, Asif Manvi, making fun of the same comedian, of the same appointment. That represented a moment of just real visibility for the South Asian community that I think didn't exist for me when I was a child.
Do you run into any resentment from Americans because of the outsourcing of jobs to India? It's likely that when you call an American company's hotline, you're going to speak to someone in Bangalore.
I think difficult economic times lead to resentment in a lot of places, and it's not unusual, and at the same time, it is disturbing.
My guest has written a book called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. But it's not just about it's not just about being an Indian that kind of migration. This book is also about your personal migration because of your sexual orientation.
Yes, I came to understand that when I came out as a lesbian, it was a kind of migration from one community and one family and one home to another. A whole new world opened up for me.
Was it doubly difficult because you were an outsider already?
In a sense, yes. I think that, you know, sort of going into an outcast status from a community that already has a bit of an outsider status can be a kind of double trauma. But at the same time, what I learned is that Indian families really value family and connection. And so ultimately, I felt very included in my family and that there is this kind of unconditional relationship that exists.
Although you report that your parents had a difficult time with your being a lesbian at first.
Yes, they certainly did. And now, 20 years later, I'm glad to say that we have a very good relationship.
So they're no longer trying to fix you up with a nice Indian boy?
That's correct. They've given up on that.
Several of your family members are in mixed marriages. Is it a concern in the diaspora communities that the Indian heritage, the journey that you've written about, will or may be lost through assimilation?
I don't think it's really a concern because India itself is still there, and so the tradition and heritage is not in any danger. There are a billion people upholding that tradition. There is certainly a concern from family to family that the specific traditions of that family might be lost. And at the same time, what I've seen is that grandparents love their grandchildren no matter what. And so even if those grandchildren are a couple of shades lighter than they might have liked, ultimately they're just so excited to have them. And it, again, I feel that, at least in my family, the culture is so accepting and so inclusive that really anything can be brought into the family, and it's the family that holds together.
You're wearing Indian clothes, and on the cover of your book, you're wearing a beautiful red sari. I suspect that when you were a kid, you wouldn't have been caught dead in that kind of clothing.
Actually, when I was a kid, I enjoyed dressing up when we went to Indian functions. And then I also was very careful about wearing my Jordache jeans to school. And there was kind of a bifurcation, actually. And so what I'm wearing now is an Indian choli, which is a blouse that traditionally goes with a sari. And over that, I have sort of a sweater dress and jeans. So I like to blend things. And that's something that I've noticed people of my generation do.
And I'm sure there are an awful lot of people in India right now wearing blue jeans as well.
Exactly.
Your background is in journalism, isn't it?
Yes, I was a reporter and editor for 8 years at the San Jose Mercury News.
How did writing a book compare with writing day-to-day journalism?
It was completely different as a process. You know, I had sort of had this idea that I could write 9,000-10,000 word articles and that would make a book, and it's actually completely different. In a book, there is an opportunity to expand intellectually and draw out the larger themes.
So you saw this chore originally as writing a series of articles that would all connect because they were related themes.
Exactly.
Like a newspaper series.
And what I found was it was not the case at all. And for the better, because that would be sort of a boring book.
Have you always wanted to write a book? You say that your first book you wrote when you were 7 years old. On a few pieces of construction paper that were stapled together.
Yes, it was a book of poems about birds dedicated to my parents. And I think I have always wanted to write a book, so it's very exciting to have this particular book that brings together a lot of the questions that I have had over my life and that brings in so many members of my family and people who are important to me.
In speaking to those members of your family who are living in other parts of the world, did you find that they had something, that they had gone through the same kinds of questioning about identity and their past and their connection to India?
Yes, there were similarities and differences. In places where there was a much larger Indian community, I think people had less struggle with their identity. They were right in the community, and you know, it was sort of like a recreation of the village in India happened in the new country. In places where they were a little bit more isolated, many of the same questions around identity did come up.
And did you find more and more people wanting to return? For example, if you speak to people in the Cuban community, even though Castro has been in power now for quite a long time, and it's unlikely that many people will return, you still get the feeling that there is that fire that's burning.
Yes, I think there's a huge difference between sort of a forced exile and a voluntary migration, and that might be one of the differences. In the Indian American community and the diaspora community, there is sometimes a nostalgia. Many people think that they'll go back and retire in India, for example, and some people do, and others find that as they go there after 30 years away, either they've changed or the place has changed, but they can no longer really live there without the comforts of their life outside.
Don't you also work as a performer?
Yes.
What kind of performing do you do?
I do performance art and poetry, and I had a show called Avatars, Gods for a New Millennium, that was at the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco a few years ago.
This book took you 7 years to complete. Are you planning to take that long on the next one?
Probably.
Well, you would try to figure out how to write a book. You're not going to have to figure that out anymore, are you?
Yes, although from what I understand from people who have written more books, it's a new process with every book. But right now, I am telling people that my next book is called 101 Naps, and I'm doing a lot of primary research for it.
I see. Sleeping through the time you should be writing?
Yes. Resting up for the next project.
Have you received any responses to this book from your extended family?
Yes, they're very excited about it. The people who have primary chapters about themselves have read their own chapters and have enjoyed them and have told me that they were surprised at how interesting it was to see how their own lives intersected with history, with these moments in social, economic, political history. And that was really what I was trying to do, was put together these personal moments of migration with what was happening in the wider world that made that migration possible.
Well, one of the problems for Indians in much of the diaspora was that they did thrive in these new countries, Uganda, for example, and in some of the Caribbean countries, and then were resented. As a minority that was doing better than many of the locals.
Yes, and many of the countries that Indians have gone to, there's been an almost immediate backlash. And I talk about that in particular in South Africa, where the apartheid regime worked very hard to keep the races very separate.
Even earlier, of course, Gandhi was involved in protests against the earlier regimes before there was apartheid.
And Gandhi's whole passive nonviolent resistance strategy was actually a product of diaspora, a product of his experiences in South Africa.
Minal Hajratwala will be reading tonight at 6 o'clock at the Corner Bookstore. That's at 1313 Madison Avenue. For more information and to RSVP, go to our show page at WNYC.org. Her book is called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.